spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your dollar a month trial today at shopify.com/records.
All right, well, let's get back to these phone lines. It's going to be Jim and Tom, and I'll get you a couple more names in just a minute. But good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
I have a question about the exposing the root flare. What exactly is the problem there? Is it oxygen or what?
You mean why do you do it?
Yes.
It is, in part, it is oxygen. It is also damage which has been done to the tree trunk, so to speak. If we took a cross-section of a tree trunk, just underneath the bark, there is a very critical layer called phloem, P-H-L-O-E-M, phloem tissue that transports nutrients from the top of the tree down to the root system of the tree. The trunk of the tree above the soil is not waterproof the way the roots and the portion under the soil are. Those cells are full of lignins and pectins and things that are used to having wet soil around them. Above the ground, those materials are not present. The bark slowly rots. The phloem slowly begins to rot. And when that layer is cut off, all of a sudden the roots have no source of energy, no source of nutrients, and the tree folds up and dies overnight. Now, there are plants which, you know, have a different physical arrangement of things. True palms and cycads, or what we call monocots, their tissues are differently arranged within the stem. Let's just leave it at that. And it doesn't really hurt to bury them deeper, but woody trees, woody shrubs, things like that, if they stay buried, it's a kiss of death.
Okay, so that root flare is actually part of the trunk.
Yes, sir. And that's what I've always said. I think the term root flare is really stupid. They ought to be calling it the trunk flare. And yeah. It's kind of like George Carlin and all his routine about the hot water heater. It doesn't heat hot water, it heats cold water, but it's a misnomer, and a trunk flare would be a much more appropriate term.
Okay, you're seeing in especially all these high-end neighborhoods, they've already ringed all the trees with mulch.
Uh-huh.
What is that, good or bad?
Bad.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, that's one of those stupid Houston habits.
Yes.
And mulch is good out over the surface of the soil, but you don't pile it up against the trunk. And it just appalls me. And there are some good landscape companies out there, but I always jokingly say all you need is a pickup truck and a plastic sign, and all of a sudden you're a landscaper and an expert. And the lack of knowledge is very apparent in a lot of the things you see around, and that mulch piled up against the tree trunks is one of them.
It seems like I read that it would attract insects into the trunk.
It will do that as well. It just weakens a tree. We had a great lecture over at our nursery last Saturday. Our friend David Vaughn, who's probably the best arborist that I've ever known in my life, gave a long talk, and he spent a lot of time talking about it. And he was saying that virtually every time somebody says, my tree just died overnight, it was fine, and then it just suddenly died, that's the thing that is caused by that. It doesn't give you any warning. By the time you see the damage that this burying of the trunk has caused, the tree's already mostly dead, and it probably, you know, it's hard to reverse if it stayed that way too long. So I don't understand why more people are not aware of the problem. I can tell you how it happens because of the way these trees, the trees are grown at the big wholesale growers. They went from paying their labor by the hour, they started paying them by the tree, by the piece. So the more plants a person could pot up, the more they got paid. So they weren't careful about doing it anymore. They just jam it in that pot, dump a bunch of soil on, and move to the next plant. And I'd say probably 95% or more of the trees and shrubs coming out of the wholesale growers these days come to you buried too deeply in the soil. And there are a lot of these dummies out there planting trees that think, oh, I'm just going to plant it a little deeper and put that soil in because it's going to prop it up better. And you just killing the trees. I'll get down off my soapbox now. But it is a very, very serious problem in landscapes today.
Well, I guess I picked up a bad habit from my dad. He would dig a 36-inch diameter hole, plant the 1-inch diameter tree 3 inches too deep, but not fill the dirt in to make a well to water in.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually when that tree gets, you know, 2 to 3 feet in diameter, that has already kind of already filled in just from nature. So.
It washes in. But in the day that your dad was doing it, he was probably getting his trees bare root or bald and burlapped and or maybe trees that were properly planted. Nowadays, if you did the same thing, that tree in the pot is already 3 inches too deep. You put it 3 inches further down, and now we've got a 6-inch problem instead of just a 3-inch problem. Yeah. So it's we actually recommend that people plant things slightly above grade. We'd like to see that plant planted too high in the soil, much more than we'd like to see it planted too low. Now, if you want to take that mulch and make yourself a nice ring of it, you know, maybe 12 inches out from the trunk, it's a great way to create a little reservoir there that can hold the water that will make, you know, soaking that tree, especially in its early days, a little bit easier. But that's the way you do it, not by planting it in a basin.
Okay. One other quick question. Is a rose for its fertilizer?
Absolutely.
Okay. And what's your best bet on fertilizing roses?
Just about any good organic fertilizer will do. I've always been very fond of a product that a company called Maestro Grove made that is called Rose Glow. We actually had them take it and improve it. We have our own proprietary brand that Gary came up with. We call it Color Essentials, but it's just improved Rose Glow. So if you're going to go out and buy a rose fertilizer, I think that's the best one. But roses really aren't that picky. You can use any good organic fertilizer out there, and then maybe add a little bit of Epsom salts. That's one thing that the roses really seem to do, like that extra magnesium. But if you use nothing more than just a good basic organic fertilizer, whether it's Nature's Creation or Medina or Maestro Grow or whosoever you use, Espoma, your roses are going to do beautifully.
My wife thinks peat moss should be used around them.
Tell her compost is a much, much better product than peat moss. Peat moss is antimicrobial. Peat moss is not a renewable resource. There are a lot of negatives about peat moss, and again, that's something our parents and grandparents did. But we're learning more and more that it's the microbes in the soil that keep our plants healthy and growing well. Peat moss is antimicrobial. That's why you could use it. I went to Ireland a few years ago. They were pulling out of some of their peat bogs. I saw a chunk of butter they said was probably 150 years old, and it would look just like the day it had been churned. I saw the head of a red stag deer, which has been extinct for 5,000 years, but it was perfectly preserved in that peat bog. That's how antimicrobial it is, and that's not the situation we want to be creating for our plant roots.
Okay, well, I'll just save it for embalming myself when I pass.
If you want your remains to be mummified, that would be that. I mean, that's exactly what it would do.
All right. Well, listen, Bob, I appreciate your show and your time.
Always a pleasure, Jim. Have a great weekend. Thank you, sir. Goodbye. All right, let's see here. Tom is up next. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm good. How about yourself?
Oh, doing real well.
Good.
I planted about a month ago a silver maple tree about 2 inches in diameter.
I'm sorry.
And they were out of my Mexican sycamore that I wanted to plant.
Yeah.
And so I planted it, and I planted it about a half inch above the ground because of the same discussion you just had about the root flare.
Uh-huh.
And when I went to try to expose to make sure that root flare was up as high as it could be, the root ball itself was so tightly wound that I couldn't really pull it away. So I just, you know, again, took it out of the container, planted it, and then have been watering it ever since, right? And so my question is, do I need to, number one, worry about the root flare? And then two, what's the best way to fertilize that tree going forward?
Well, you do need to worry about the root flare, and you really need just to get in there with pruning shears or a hay hook or whatever you can use. All of that little tightly wound material. You actually described it better than I could. That is not good for the tree. But the tree, having stayed buried in that container for probably a couple of years before you got it, it's put all these little fine fibrous roots up above where the root flare should be, and you will not hurt the tree by pruning those away and cutting them back, pulling everything away. And you need to do that until you get down to where the root flare is. Otherwise, you're definitely shortening the life of that tree. Now, what part of town do you live in, Tom?
In north central San Antonio.
Do you have deep soil or shallow soil?
Shallow soil.
Well, my old friend Alton Grimm taught me a long time ago, there's no such thing as a good plant or a bad plant. All plants have some good characteristics and some bad characteristics. Silver maple is not a quality tree. I don't know any way to soften that blow. It's a crappy tree, and I don't think they should be sold here. They'll be beautiful for about 5 to 10 years, and then they start having extreme chlorosis problems. And, again, I learned so much from my friend and mentor, Alton Grimm, who sadly passed away about a little over a year ago. But every time I would ask Alton about a new tree or something like that, he'd say, have you ever seen a big one? Have you ever seen, how many of them do you see growing around? And I would defy you to find very much in the way of silver maples growing anywhere in the area, and that's because they just don't live very long for the most part. Now, I guess I could, and you sound like you have a sense of humor, so I'm teasing you a little bit, but at least hopefully by the time this tree dies, you'll be able to find a Mexican sycamore and plant the tree that I wish you'd been able to find in the first place. But silver maple is just plain and simply not a good long-term tree, but it's going to be pretty for the next 5 to 10 years. As far as fertilizing it, just use the same stuff you use on your grass, just any good basic organic fertilizer, and keep it well mulched. Probably add some magic sand or green sand periodically. That will, you know, delay the onset of its problems, but eventually that tree's going to start getting its roots down into the poor caliche soils and all. And let's just say that long term, I tell you, I would go somewhere near that spot in your yard, and I'd plant a different tree to take over when that silver maple gives up on you.
Got it. And then if for some reason it does get sick quickly, when do Mexican sycamores start to show up in nurseries? Because I could not find one.
Well, we've got them. I imagine Fanix has them. They're just, see, here's the problem with a Mexican sycamore. It grows so quickly that the big wholesalers that we used to buy 5 and 15 gallon trees from, which is the size that you or I can transplant, they just started sticking them all in 30 and 90 gallon containers, which weigh 500 pounds, and you can't move them without a bobcat. And right. So they're just trying to get as much money out of them. We're actually having to go quite a long way, and they're still difficult to find, but they're not the only good tree. They're just the fastest growing tree out there. But a Monterey oak, which does not get oak wilt, is going to be another real good choice. A cedar elm might be a good choice. A bur oak could be a good choice. There are lots of other trees out there. And like I say, the best thing going for Mexican sycamore, it's not a perfect tree either. It's not as long live, but, you know, 50, 60 years, probably going to do most of us all we need. And it just happens to be the fastest growing good quality shade tree out there.
Got it. Listen, thank you very much. And I do appreciate your show, too.
Well, I appreciate your call this morning. Hope you have a wonderful weekend and a happy St. Patty's Day tomorrow. You sound like the kind of guy that you get out and celebrate.
I will.
We'll just leave it right there. I know a lot of people are going to be drinking a lot of green beer and things like that tomorrow, but hey, St. Patrick's Day is definitely a good holiday. All right, let's get back to gardening. It's going to be Linda and Chris and Kim, and Linda's up first. Good morning, Linda.
Hi. You just got through talking about the phloem going down with the nutrients mm-hmm. outside the bar, just inside the bark.
Right.
Does the water flow up through the center of the tree?
Yeah, it's called xylem tissue is the center of the tree, and that's what takes water from the root system to the top of the tree. It's an interesting thing. It moves by something we call osmotic pressure. Xylem cells are actually dead tissue. They don't even have nuclei in them. But, yeah, that is the standard trunk structure on a woody stem tree. Xylem in the middle, phloem outside of that. There's a layer called the cambium in between those two that makes new cells of both xylem and phloem. And then you've got your bark around beyond that.
Okay, because I always wonder, they say, oh, you cut out the middle of the tree, it's dead, it doesn't do anything, but you're losing your water supply system when you cut
it. But, you know, that's a real interesting point, and that's a point David addressed in his lecture last week, that the tree has way more xylem than it needs. And if you've got a hollow tree, but you have as much as 4 inches left all the way around, let's say you have a tree that's 20 inches in diameter with a big hole down the middle of it, if that outer layer is 4 inches thick, the tree has everything it needs, and it's also structurally just almost 100% as strong as a tree with no hole in the middle of it whatsoever. And this is based on some really good research, so I've learned a lot dealing with good arborists, and I just do my best to share it with you when I can.
Got another question here. You said orchids, substrate for them to grow on charcoal and bark, tree bark?
Many orchids are the largest family of flowering plants in the world, so it's very hard to generalize because there are so many different kinds. But the orchids, most of the orchids that we grow for decorative purposes are in nature epiphytes, meaning that they grow up on trees, or sometimes the lithophytes grow up on rocks. But all the ones that are used to growing above the ground, I grow them in a mixture of charcoal and bark, and I think that's the very best thing. Now, there are a handful of orchids that are commercially grown, like Paphiopedilums or lady slippers and Cymbidiums, that are in nature terrestrial. They normally grow in the soil. I grow those in a mixture of core, compost, and a little bit of old bark in there. But most all the orchids, certainly the orchids that you find at the grocery stores and things like that, they will be very happy in that charcoal and bark mix.
What is the point of the charcoal? What does it do?
Charcoal is a great purifying agent, and as things start to break down and decay, both old roots and as the bark begins to decay, charcoal takes many of the toxins out. That's why charcoal is used as a filter in fish tanks, is used as a filter in many different types of air conditioners and things like that. But the charcoal is there to absorb primarily nitrogenous waste products.
Now, in nature, there wouldn't be charcoal. Is it because they're growing up on trees and that stuff gets washed away?
You're exactly right. But, and, you know, you can grow them that way. You can mount them on a slab of wood. Some people mount them on a slab of cork. Some people will mount them on a slab of tree fern. And many orchids will grow beautifully that way, but you've got to be home to spray them down with water 2 or 3 times a day because that's the thing. In nature, many of these things live in the cloud forest, or they live in areas. They either live in areas which have very regular moisture, or else they have developed these big, thick structures called pseudobulbs, which are designed by nature to help the plant get through the drought period. So they're a little bit more trouble, and certainly no commercial grower is going to invest the time and effort to grow these things on slab. It's much easier to grow them in pots. And so that's the way most of us do it. But come to the Orchid Show next week down at the Garden Center, and you'll see plants growing both ways, and you'll have a lot of people you can ask any interesting question that comes up about orchids.
Pseudomulch. What's pseudomulch?
Pseudomulch.
Cedar. I didn't hear what you said. Cedar mulch is what sounds like pseudo mulch. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm down here in Divine. We haven't had a drop of useful rain in months.
Yeah, we're pretty much the same way in the hill country. But, for growing the terrestrial orchids, there's something called core, C-O-I-R. That mixed with some good compost, mixed with some of the fine bark, that's the mix we make for growing lady slipper orchids, Paphiopedilums, and the Cymbidiums. But your Cattleyas, your Phalaenopsis, Your oncidiums, your epidendrums, most all of those, that mix of charcoal and bark is all you need.
Okay, sorry to ask such technical questions.
Not a problem. I enjoy talking about it. I try to generalize for most people, but if you've got a question that will help you, if it's something I'm familiar with, I'll share every bit of knowledge I can with you.
Thanks so much. Enjoy your show.
I appreciate it, Linda. Thank you. I probably enjoy your calls. Chris is up next. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Bob, and everybody else.
Good morning.
Insights. Several years ago, you talked about a Mexican live oak planting it, and I think it was Edder who actually said, plant it on top of the ground, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a five-year-old, was one-inch trunk, bought 5 years ago. Now it's almost 50 feet,
mm-hmm.
45 feet around, and doing absolutely great.
Yeah.
Number two, I've called a number of times. I have this huge, giant live oak that was buried 4 feet deep.
Uh-huh.
Well, 4.5 feet now. I finally exposed the roots. And it's now doing really good. I had a bunch of ball moss. A lot of that's starting to fall off.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, for your listeners, that's one way of doing it if you expose that tree root and all that.
Well, unfortunately, some of the ball moss falling off is... that's just ball moss dying and getting blown loose by the wind. So ball moss is not a parasite, so it may or may not help. But it certainly helps.
But someone called one time about that.
Yeah.
And so I just let him know, how do I get rid of it? Well, when you expose the root and all that, the tree gets really healthy. It tends to go. Potatoes. Plant potatoes.
Uh-huh.
3 inches, 4 inches deep after you cut all the eyes out? Not all, yeah, you know what I mean.
Yeah, after you cut them up to the appropriate size. I probably plant them an inch deep. You can plant them deeper if you want to.
And then you pile stuff on top as they recommend or not?
You know, I've done it both ways, and I've not seen a lot of difference. They call that banking when they kind of mound the soil up around them. I've tried it both ways, and I get plenty of potatoes whether I take the time to bank the soil up around them or not. But the soil in my garden is fairly loose.
I did fall potatoes, and then I was, you know, dug some of them up and all that. Now I was planting yesterday some more, and all of a sudden I find a bunch of the potatoes underneath the ground already.
Right.
Still from last fall.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, where do y'all come from? Thought I got y'all.
Well, harvest some of them and enjoy them.
That's what I'm doing. The last thing is I have a whole bank of roses that I use as a windbreak or something else, but it's also where the chickens love to sit under and poop under.
Sure.
So other than 2 feet above where nothing grows below that because of the chickens, all the poop, all that other stuff is perfectly good. I know it's good for the roses, but... what other supplements should I use?
If your roses are doing well, don't do a thing. If you don't have any, if your roses are doing fine, I see no reason to do anything else, Chris. Listen, I got to get a break out of the way here, and then we'll be visiting with Kim and Celeste. All right, let's get back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Looks like it's going to be Kim and Celeste and Janie, and Kim is up first. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning. I have... A small kumquat tree that I think, looking at photos, it has a zinc deficiency. What can I use to help it?
I've never seen a zinc deficiency in kumquats. I guess it's possible. I think it's more likely iron. So are the veins green and the rest of the leaf yellow?
It's yellow, yes.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you the most common thing I see in citrus when it's yellowing, it's just it's gotten too dry at some point. But if the problem is iron or zinc or magnesium or any of those other metallic elements, just get a little bit of, I still like ladybugs, what they call magic sand, and a lot of nurseries still have that. If you don't find that, Carl Poole makes a green sand product called Jersey Green Sand, and then you can buy ordinary green sand in several different brand names, and that should totally correct the problem. But, you know, many of the fertilizers, the people actually add some green sand to them. So what is your basic fertilizer that you're using on your kumquat?
I just use compost.
Okay, you need to be using a good basic fertilizer. It might be Espoma, it might be Medina, it might be Nature's Creation. All those folks make good fertilizers that have all the micronutrients you use in there. Compost, unless that compost were made from some sort of tissue that had a lot of iron or zinc in it, that is not alone, that's probably not all the fertilizer. That's sort of the vitamins, but it doesn't give you your basic nutrients. So at least every 2 or 3 months, I'd be putting a good basic fertilizer on it. And I think that problem will go away without having to buy a supplement.
And what should be the number on the fertilizer?
Don't even pay any attention to numbers. Numbers are totally meaningless in today's world because many of your higher numbered fertilizers, the fertilizer in what we call an anion form, which means it doesn't bind to the soil, only about 10% of it actually goes to the plant. So it might say 20%, might have a 20 for a first number, and yet your plant's actually only getting 2%, where a good organic product, most of the nutrient is in a form we call a cation, which binds to the soil, and the plants get 100% of it. And if it has the number 4, then your plants are getting all 4%. It's a little confusing. Right. It's a little easier to explain on a blackboard, but your plants get more nutrient from a 4% nitrogen organic fertilizer than they get from a 20% nitrogen synthetic fertilizer.
Like I have some Happy Frog, which is a tomato and vegetable, which is a 7-4-5, and should I be looking for some other combination?
Happy Frog is a good organic product, and that would be excellent for your citrus.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're sure welcome. Thank you. That's the thing about many of these products. Many companies will make fertilizers, and then they'll make it sound like, oh, you can only use it on roses, or you can only use it on tomatoes or whatever. These products are great for just about anything you put them on. Maybe they put something a little extra special in. Maybe they put some extra magnesium for the roses. But they're not limited to just one specific plant. And no, on her kumquat, that tomato and vegetable food is going to work just fine. My next caller is Celeste. Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How about yourself?
Doing fine, thank you.
Good.
My question is about daylilies.
Uh-huh.
I just really love them, and I wanted to start a little daylily bed, and I know they take sun, right?
Yes, they need a fair amount of, they need as much sun as you can give them to really bloom well.
Right, okay, so I have a spot in my backyard where I think I want to do that, and I just didn't know if how I should best prepare the soil, or any tips you can give me about what they might need to really bloom. I mean, I know they only open one day.
Well, no, that's not really true. I'll tell you a little bit about soil preparation, then I'll tell you about daylily specifically. But any good soil, you want to have plenty of organic material in the soil, and good compost is probably the single best place to get that. Now, if you want to hold moisture a little bit better, you can add some lava sand. It's a permanent addition. It has what we call a high cation exchange potential, and it helps hold a lot of moisture in the soil. If you want to add... Holly, there are just so many different things. There are products like zeolite, there are products like azomite, all these things that if you have and you want to add, you certainly can. I think adding a little green sand or magic sand is a good thing to do. And but beyond that, just any good garden soil is going to be fine for growing your daylilies. But here's the thing about daylilies. There are basically three types of daylilies, and you have what we call the deciduous ones that always freeze back. You have what they call the evergreen ones, which usually have foliage year-round. And then you have what we call the semi-evergreens that are sort of halfway in between. The ones that do absolutely the best in this area are the evergreens, and some of the semi-evergreens will do well as well. But a lot of these really fancy daylily varieties, these things you see on the internet, the things you see in the, you know, perennial catalogs and things like that, they are varieties that take a much colder climate to do well. So it's not just how you prepare the soil, it's the varieties of daylilies that you choose. And if you stick with the evergreens and some of the semi-evergreens, that's going to be one of the biggest steps in being successful with your daylily, Celeste.
Okay, and I've seen some daylily beds where they're really tall, but most of the time I thought they were short.
It all depends on the variety. There are a number, just like their re-blooming iris, there are a number of new daylily varieties out there which bloom more than once during the season. Stella de Oro and many of its hybrids are some of the daylilies that are rebloomers. And most all the rebloomers that I have seen are shorter statured plants. Most of the ones that make the taller plants, you get that one bloom period in the spring. And I think the day, you know, hibiscus only lasts for one day, but daylilies usually 3 or 4 or 5 days. The cooler the weather is, the longer the blooms will last. But most of your taller daylilies, you're going to get that one spring bloom, and that's going to be it.
But they're good for all summer, and especially like July and August, right?
The plants will be pretty, and they will do very well, but you're probably not going to get more flowers in August than July and August, unless you go with things like your Stella de Oro that are reblooming types that can bloom more than once during the season.
Okay, back to the sand. Was lava sand and magic sand two different things should do, or just one or the other?
No, they're two different things. Lava sand is basically ground-up lava, and it is, again, there are a lot of things it does, but probably the principal thing is they help with holding moisture in the soil. Your green sands or magic sand, this is a different sand, comes from ancient seabeds and lake floors that is very high in metallic elements like iron and zinc. And green sand is probably good for a year or two, but it's something that you will reapply periodically. Lava sand is going to be there for the next 1,000 years.
Okay. All right. Well, good information. I'll get started.
Well, and do look around. We have a daylily society, actually, in San Antonio. They meet down at the Garden Center, and these people are really purist. But just keep in mind that the variety is very important. Check your good nurseries around and be real careful of those pretty little catalogs that come in the mailbox, because most of the varieties you find in there probably are not going to be real good for this area.
But you have all the evergreen and semi-evergreen?
We do later in the season. It's a little bit early yet. I think Fanix does a pretty good job of carrying them. But, yes, they are certainly things that where they're available, we try to find them. This is a weird year in the nursery business, not to tell you, you know, a lot about what's going on in the world of the nurseryman, but with the lack of sun this spring, the growers are behind. Things that we normally would be getting in big supplies by the end of February simply aren't going to be ready till the middle or end of March. I guess this is the middle of March now, Ides of March yesterday, but most nurseries are not quite as well stocked as we normally are this time of year, just because the lack of sun, things aren't growing quite as quickly. But they will be out there. You get your beds ready, and then we'll help you find what you're looking for.
Okay, great. Well, thank you a lot, and you have a great day.
You do the same, Celeste. Appreciate the call. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye. All right, back to gardening. I think we have just about the right amount of time to talk to Janie. Good morning, Janie.
Good morning.
Good morning. How can I help today?
Okay, I have a Piscoporium.
Piscoporium
shrub.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Two of them in my front front of my house, and the leaves are turning yellow.
Okay.
And there's in one spot on the side, it's almost dead.
Okay.
You know, the branches. So anyway, what is it lacking, or is it?
Well, a little bit of yellowing is normal at this time of year. I've got a Piscoporium outside my back door. It's about 15 feet wide and about 12 feet tall.
Yeah,
and
there are
a lot of yellow leaves. How does the new growth, are you seeing any new growth coming out on the plant?
No. Okay. Well, it's gotten pretty big. It probably needs to be cut back some, but I don't think it's really coming out a whole lot.
Okay.
I took a picture of it. I could probably send you a picture of it.
You can.
That would help.
I don't think that's really necessary. I would give it some of the same fertilizer that you're going to put on your grass, any of the good organic products, Medina, Nature's mm-hmm. Creation, any of those good ones will benefit your pittosporum as well. Pittosporums now are like trees, and we talk so much about the importance of at the bottom of that plant, the root flare needs to be exposed. You don't want to have soil piled up around the trunk, or that can lead to those, you know, big dead areas in the plant. So somebody really needs to get down, and there's just not an easy way to do it. Get down on your hands and knees and perhaps, you know, pull the soil away from the main trunk of the plant until you find those roots flaring out, you know, going out sideways from the bottom of the plant. Green pittosporum has a very long life. This one behind my back door, I'm guessing, has probably been there 80 years or so. And the bottom of that plant, the trunk is maybe 18 inches in diameter. So they can live a long, long time. Now, I see some yellow leaves just from lack of water. And we are dry. I mean, this little rain we had this past week is the first time we've had more than about a tenth of an inch of rain at one time. And I've still got cracks in my yard. You still get down more than half an inch deep, and that soil's just dry, dry, dry. So give your big pittosporum a very, very thorough watering. Give it, you know, again, just a good basic organic fertilizer you'd be putting on your grass. But when you're able, or have somebody, you know, do this for you, get down and look at the base of the plant. If it looks like a fence post sticking up out of the ground, it's buried, and you've got to pull the soil back away from the trunk of the plant down to where you see those roots flaring out, or ultimately it will die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's been there about 45 years.
Yeah.
So I didn't fertilize. I didn't get a chance to fertilize in the fall.
Just do it now.
I usually, I had planned on it, and so I didn't know if it needed maybe some other nutrients other than just the fertilizer.
No, if you're using a good organic fertilizer, it's got everything you need in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'll try that because I sure hate to lose it.
Oh, yeah. I think you'll be fine, but give it a thorough watering, a little fertilizing, and it should look lots better.